you know, what is this, fifth prime minister in 6 years?
Absolutely.
Our shared humanity contains an immensely precious diversity of thought.
You see, once people were at work, there wasn't a rule that says when you're at work, you couldn't eat cake.
You begged us, you pleaded, you promised to send us unmarked banknotes. So we're back. This is the What and the Why podcast for March 2023. May the Lord have mercy on our souls.
Well, I have to go now.
So do I. It's going to hit the fan around here, and I want to watch it happen.
Welcome to the What and the Why for the years 2023 to 2027 inclusive. Yes, it's your biannual, or is it quad-yearly rundown of what's going on in the world of geopolitics, politics, culture, and generally whatever takes our fancy. You want a podcast that can tell the difference between a turnip and a Swede? You've come to the right place. You might have also suspected that either I'm not Tim, or he's done the right thing and finally moved to the sensible side of the Pennines. I am David Waywell, and Tim is currently waiting in the wings to arrive like James Brown. In a few moments, the band will start up, I'll help him out of his cape, and he'll approach the microphone and give a soulful yelp about your mama doing that thing. And then the show will begin. What might we talk about in this episode? Well, what won't we talk about? War in Ukraine? Chinese expansion in the South China Sea? New submarines? Israel's political crisis? Britain's political crisis? America's political crisis? Turkmenistan's political crisis? Does Turkmenistan have a political crisis? I don't know. The return of Donald Trump or the arrival of Ron DeSantis, Gary Lineker, the BBC? We won't talk football. I don't want to talk about football. And I'm sure Tim doesn't want to talk about football. So here he is, fresh from his tour of Glossop, Tin Twistle, Wig Twistle, it's near Sheffield. It's the hardest working man in show business. It's the godfather of geopolitics. It's the man who invented heated blancmange. It's Tim Marshall. Hello, Tim.
Well, hello, David. And let's talk about football, shall we, and Real Madrid. No, no, we won't do that.
That's tonight, isn't it?
It's been a wee while.
It has been a wee while. I remember when last time we talked, like, Liverpool had a great team. I think you still had Bielsa.
We've just gone past the year anniversary of one of the saddest moments of my life, which tells you I've led a very sheltered life, because I still am not quite over losing Marcelo Bielsa. I do still have his statue in my backyard, but... You mentioned an awful lot of crises up there at the top.
I know, I did.
All right, well, let's get on with it. Which crises would you like to discuss?
World War III. Let's talk about World War III first.
Not going to be one, probably, so...
I know. But I think we have to reassure people, because the media's been... I mean, it's not so much the media, I suppose it's social media, but they make so much out of every single event. Like, there was an event I was out yesterday, so I kind of missed the headline, but it was, didn't America, one of America's drones get taken down by a Russian jet, which then crashed?
Basically, over the Black Sea, the Americans had a reconnaissance drone up, which is a regular occurrence, and the Russians know this.
International waters?
Yes, but for whatever reason, the Russians decided that they would fly one of their MiGs towards it and force it down, which they did. Which is, they say no, they didn't. But that, you know, that's dangerous stuff. I mean, basically, they're signalling. They're signalling we're not frightened of you. They're signalling they're prepared to take various actions. They're daring the Americans because, you know, they know the Americans don't want to fight. So it was an interesting and a dangerous episode, which has now gone past. These things happen.
Russia outplayed it quickly, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, both sides know that NATO forces are desperate not to get involved on the ground and in the air within Ukraine. And I still think they're not going to. But short of that, they're going to do everything to try to make sure Russia loses in the short term. I mean, sorry, we've been through this, and I'll try and frame it. We're over a year in. I wouldn't call it stalemate, because we haven't had the spring offensives yet. But But the Ukrainians have ground the Russians to a halt with better tactics and better weapons because of NATO. The Russians are now throwing cannon fodder at them and will continue to do so and try to break their will by making the civilian population suffer. And on it grinds. And we will have a clearer picture in 2 or 3 months after the spring offensives. There's different clocks ticking, but one of the Russian clocks is that they want the clock to move fast to get to the end of the Europeans' and Americans' support for Ukraine, or rather the degree of support. And they're hoping we either get bored or concerned about how much money we're spending or concerned about how dangerous it is and actually stop supporting them to the extent we are. And
well, it was ominous, wasn't it, yesterday, was it? Well, the last couple of days, DeSantis has come out and said, basically, I mean, he signaled that he's going to withdraw American support if he gets in.
Exactly. And this is the other clock, another clock that's ticking, and it's the US election. Putin would love a Trump victory and a DeSantis victory now, if DeSantis runs, and, you know, I assume you agree he's probably going to.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And would have a decent chance of winning, probably a better chance than Trump, unless, I mean, sorry, we've gone into US politics, but unless Trump stands as an independent, which actually I think is also probable. Let's park that for a minute and come back to it. So Putin is also working to the US electoral clock, because he wants a Republican victory if he can hang on for, what is it, a year and a half, 2 years. Because then if the Americans don't support Ukraine, the European support will crumble. And Russia, because it's, you know, three times the size of Ukraine, can win a war of attrition. So all these different clocks are running. But at the moment, the Ukrainians are not losing.
How's he doing domestically, Putin? Because I'm shocked, because the death toll must be far exceeding like Afghanistan now. And Afghanistan was considered like the breaking point of like the old Soviet regime, wasn't it?
He actually genuinely appears to be holding up in the polls. It's not the high 80s as it used to be. But there's a number of things going on. Remember, a country at war often rallies around the flag, and there's a great degree of that has happened. Also, the majority of the losses, you're talking about people from the far east of Russia. You're talking about people near the Chinese border or from the Caucasus. You're not talking about the middle class kids from St. Petersburg and from Moscow. You're talking about that, about the greatest losses are being suffered by the minorities. And so the scepticism and media scepticism is not there the way it might do if it was their own kids getting killed in such great numbers. But I think even more important than that, David, is the media. You know, Putin spent the last 20 years, but particularly the last 5 years, just clamping down on everything. And there's very, very little independent media left. And so consequently, Russians are fed a constant diet, night after night, of a very alternative view to the one that we get. And there's a lot of people that buy it. Those that don't buy it, well, I'm afraid they're smart enough to have either left the country, a million young Russian men have left to avoid conscription, or they just keep shtum. And so what you're left with is those that do support. And so there isn't this massive groundswell saying end this war now. And I'm afraid that's going to continue for some time. I mean, you've got to think that at some level people are thinking, you know, the losses. But the Russian public have not been told the losses. Of course, individual areas will know that, you know, some of their sons are not coming home. But they will not have been told what the NATO assessments are, which is that they have lost at least 50,000 troops, at least, and with more than that injured.
Yeah, the whole thing about Putin and the media is very sober. I mean, I know we have conversations in this country about the media and the independence of the media, especially like Lineker in the last week. And there's a certain amount of it like going a little bit hyperbolic about it. But at the same time, you know, it's a sort of lesson, like, you know, you do need to sort of keep control of, try to keep an independent media. You can't allow the government to... tinker too much, I think.
I think you're right. I mean, there is a connection there with the whole Lineker story, but I mean, we are talking, you know, several degrees away from that sort of alleged level of government control. While we're on the subject, I would like to actually move briefly back to US politics in a minute, but a story that hasn't got much coverage, which I think is very important this week, is Moldova. It's a cracking story as well. As you know, Moldova borders Ukraine. And between most of Moldova and the Ukrainian border is a breakaway republic called Transnistria.
Yeah. And isn't this the story right at the beginning of the Ukraine story where when Russia invaded, there was a suspicion they were actually going to push on to Moldova?
Yeah, well, they were. There's no question in my mind that the original plan, which was to take most of Ukraine, if not all of it, was absolute. And you looked at all the positioning and everything that the fighting of the first few weeks. They intended to go along the Black Sea coast, all the way to the Moldovan border, at which point this breakaway republic, Transnistria, there's 2,000 Russian troops there that were left behind at the end of the Cold War. And this is a Russian-speaking region of Moldova, which did break away from the government. And so you would then have contiguous territory in Moldova all the way along the Black Coast, and you'd have cut Ukraine off from the sea. So they didn't make it. You know, because of the fiasco of the inept and corrupt military. But that doesn't mean that the Kremlin gives up. They've spent the last year trying to foment dissent within Moldova, and that came to a head this week. And like I said, it's a cracking story. Basically, Red Star Belgrade, Partizan, sorry, we're going to play one of the Belgrade clubs. We're going to play football in the breakaway republic. And the Moldovan president says that the Russians were going to fly in lots of mercenaries, you know, several hundred, as posing as fans. Mm. And after the game, there was going to be a hell of a lot of trouble. And then they were going to go on and seize hostages and try to take some key positions, because there's quite a few people inside the area that would help them.
That takes football hooliganism to a new level, doesn't it?
Well, as you know, I used to know Arkan of the Serbian Tigers,
yeah.
And he made his whole career by being a football hooligan and then
rising up to become a mercenary. That's one of your best stories. That,
yeah. So, I mean, I think there seems to be a lot of truth in this, and so what they did, the Moldovans, was for about 3 days before the game, they closed the airspace. They also turned back several people that they say were in the Wagner. You know, the Russian mercenary army that's fighting in Ukraine. They said they turned a lot of them away from the airport in the days before the airspace was closed. And so it didn't happen. It does look like it's a legit story. Bellingcat and others and Yahoo News, there's been several media have come together to produce a report. I think it's got the more than the ring of truth about it. But I mean, what a cracking story that is.
Why do you think it's not got the exposure? I mean, it's a stupid question because I've just written an article about why no stories have any exposure in the last week, because it's all been about Lineker. But why do you think it kind of gets under
I think it's a faraway country about which we know little. I think it's a very complicated story. And I think there's a lot of news around. I mean, tomorrow morning, you know, short of World War III, which we both agree is not going to happen. And we're onto a good one there, David, because if it does, you know, people are going to be too busy to say, hang on a minute, David and Tim said, you know, so it doesn't really matter.
There was a story about that a few weeks ago where it was a case. Oh, it was the balloons. And it was a case of why didn't Biden just come out and say, these are balloons? They had to leave it for, like, I think, 2 or 3 days where the speculation
started. Yeah, they look bad. Sorry, so to answer
that, UFOs.
Let me answer the first question, which is, to make the point that on Thursday morning, unless World War III has happened, anything else is going to get completely blitzed by the British, what do you call it? I'm not paying much attention to it. The budget, that's the word, the budget.
Oh, today.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, you'll get 7 pages. And I quite understand that. People want to know, you know, how much tax they're going to have to or have to not pay next year, et cetera, et cetera. I get it. So it's, you know, it's a whole bunch of reasons. Right. What did you just mention that was really interesting? Yeah, the balloons. We'll come back to that.
The balloons.
But we never got to DeSantis.
Well, we'll get to Senator Santos in a minute. Let me finish my balloon point.
Yes.
All I was going to say was Biden should have just come out and said these aren't UFOs, because if they were UFOs, the news that they were UFOs would completely obliterate
David,
that he got it wrong anyway.
David, so, get into 2023, yeah, will you? I know it's a year since we've spoken in this format. It's not UFOs anymore, mate.
How long ago were the balloons? That was January.
No, the point I'm making, my learned friend, is that we don't call them UFOs anymore. But having tried to belittle you, I've now forgotten what they are called.
I remember the story now. Yeah, they don't.
They're
call
now
UFOs,
called UAPs, mate. They are unidentified aerial phenomena. Which is an old Muppet song. You might remember it.
It is an old Muppet song. Show me.
No, it's straight up. So, apparently, you know, if you want to sound like you know what you're on about, you say UF, whatever it was.
Let's quickly touch on the balloons, because I kind of forgot about them. But it was a fascinating story. What did you make of it? Was it more kind of poor management, news management by Biden? Or
no, I think it, I think they were busy and they had other things to do. And it wasn't a news story, so why make it one? Okay, because look, they knew about this balloon, and it's not. Of course, it is a balloon, but the important thing is what's underneath it, which about 20 meters down. There's this massive iron steel platform bristling with antennae and cameras, and the ability to send the information that they're getting straight up to a Chinese satellite, probably encrypted, and then downloaded into a computer in Beijing. That's what it is. So, without any question, they monitored it, and it came over Alaska, then it drifted, if you believe the Chinese version, it drifted into Canada. Now, this is not a news story yet, because the news media don't know about it. Why would you want to make it one? It then drifts down into the United States, and then, you know, by sheer coincidence, if you're the Chinese, it happens to just sort of go over the American nuclear weapons silos and stay there for a while, taking photographs of them.
Do you believe that they were drifting? Because I know.
No, I've not. I don't believe they were drifting for a millisecond. Yeah. Not for a millisecond. You know, it's not a coincidence they ended up over the nuclear silos.
No, that's true.
At this point, some bloke in a cowboy hat looked up at the sky and said, "What's that, Irene?" And took a photograph, and it was in the local media, then the regional media, and very quickly the national media, and suddenly it's a story, and suddenly Biden's got to do something about it. Now, I thought were a bit clumsy was not, as you said, immediately saying, this is what it is, because obviously they'd had the fighter jets up there looking at it. They knew what it was. Mm. This is what it is.
They shut one down. Yeah.
Yeah, this is what we think it's doing. And then telling the American public, because the Republicans made hay with this, telling the American public, the reason we are not shooting it down is that this is like shooting down something with the weight of a double-decker bus, and we just don't know where it's going to land. And, you know, we don't want it landing on a school and killing 150 kids. That's not a difficult message to get across, but they didn't. They let it go for almost 48 hours without explaining anything, and the Republicans were calling them weak. Then it drifted. It went over the sea, the Gulf of Mexico, I believe, at which point a U.S. fighter jet went up, fired, I think it was a Sidewinder missile at it, and brought it down.
Which is an expensive way to bring down a balloon. I mean, it looked like it actually went straight through it at first.
Yeah. It fell from, I think it was 56,000 feet into the sea. Yeah. They then obviously went to salvage it, and I'm pretty sure didn't tell us everything that they found, because they don't want the Chinese to know how much they found and what they've assessed from it, because what we're not sure about is just what was its capability, what was the aperture of the camera, you know, because military grade surveillance kit in the satellites, for example, it can get down within a meter of what's the word I'm looking for? Clarity of image, below that, in fact. And this kit is not sold on the commercial market. It's still within the militaries of various countries. So what was its sophistication? And equally important, what was its capability of sending that information in encrypted packets up to the Chinese satellites and back down? And they probably don't want the Chinese to know how much they know. But they did recover things, and crisis over for the time being. But it was a fascinating episode.
The unspoken side of that was all the reverse engineering that was going on, because I think that was originally one of the reasons people gave that they weren't going to shoot it down, because actually the Americans were learning a lot about how China spies, what kind of technologies they had, even kind of the encryption that's being used.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, I think you're right that, you know, they will have been trying to intercept any stuff that was going up to see what it was. The other question a lot of people had is, well, why on earth did they need a balloon when they've got satellites? Did I mention I've got a new book coming out next month called The Future of Geography about astropolitics? I'm glad you asked, David. I've got a new book coming out next month. It's called The Future of Geography. It's about astropolitics, basically how international relations is now also moving to space. Anyway, therefore, I know a little bit about this. The satellites in low Earth orbit are travelling extraordinarily quickly, and they're only over a certain piece of the Earth for a limited period of time, because they're going round and round and round much faster than the Earth is going round and round and round. So they can capture it, but they can't stay there above it. The ones in geosynchronous orbit, well, they're about another 35,000 kilometres higher up. So obviously their cameras are looking a lot further down. Geosynchronous means that they are going round the Earth at the same speed that the Earth is going round. So consequently, they are always above the same spot, which is pretty useful if you're trying to look at one thing that isn't moving. Right. The balloons, of course, they can stay over much lower down with very good cameras for longer periods of time and get a much better snapshot. For example, how many people drive in and out of that complex in any given two-hour period. How many trucks they think, you know, just a whole bunch of intel that then goes into the massive pot of jigsaw pieces as you try to make your picture of what you think is going on.
Plus, I think they've also got antennae which will listen in on like mobile communications, which I don't think you can do from like orbit.
Exactly, you know, there's all this stuff. Oh, by the way, that made me write, I don't know if you read it, I wrote a piece for reaction.life about the crane story, because the Americans are now concerned that the Chinese cranes in their ports are spying on them. And a lot of people guffawed about this as if it was paranoia.
Sorry, I just had an image of the Chinese, like, you know, cranes as in storks. I'm thinking they're trained birds over now. Sorry, you mean the cranes as in, yeah. Okay.
Well, the Egyptians once accused the Israelis of training sharks to carry bombs and blow them up and eat tourists and things. I mean, I'm not sure you can train a shark like training a cat. Anyway, the cranes, and can we go back to DeSantis in a moment? The cranes, 80% of cranes in American ports are made by one Chinese company. In these cranes, of course, is a lot of software. These are the ship-to-shore cranes, the ones that, you know, are on the ships, lift the massive containers up, stick them on the shore. So if you're doing that and you've got the software, theoretically, you know how many containers, and you know what's in them, are being shipped. So you know a lot about the American economy. And some of these cranes, in Europe, for example, in Italy, are in one of the ports in Italy that is used as a NATO transport hub. So I was writing this article that they're not necessarily spying on anybody, but they do have the capacity. And this is the modern 21st century espionage. Because another one, if the Chinese were saying, you're paranoid, you're nuts. Well, why do the Chinese, when Xi moves to a city or the Politburo meets in a particular city, how come Tesla cars are not allowed in that city for about 2 months? Why is that?
I didn't know that.
It's because Tesla cars are crammed full of cameras, and theoretically, and it's only theory, I'm not saying this is happening, but theoretically, if you can upload all the information from all these cameras, you can build a picture of who is in that particular area for how long. For example, outside a military base, how many people are coming in and out of, what are their patterns of behavior, etc., etc. And so, of course, the intelligence agencies have to get up to speed, and most of them are, with the 21st century tech, and look at what is possible. So I just wrote this article to try and say, don't guffaw and snigger just because it looks like it's mad to think that cranes can spy. They can.
No, it's there's a story a couple of months ago, maybe about a month ago, about the Chinese actually most CCTV cameras in the UK being like manufactured in China.
Yeah.
And it, on one side of the story, it's slightly extreme to say, you know, China's spying on us, but my background was software engineering. Mm. And you don't necessarily have to have a system inside that camera to say, I'm going to be reporting back to my Chinese paymasters in Beijing. But if you're in China and you're working for those companies, all you need to do is leave a back door, yeah. Leave an easy accessible way into that camera. So you know that any camera in the UK, if it's built in China and is networked onto a Wi-Fi network,
well, this is why many other countries around the world. It's also why I suspect there will be a bill that probably will get through Congress within a year to strip out some of the software from the Chinese cranes. I was in a home office training building in a nice remote country house a few months ago, and I noticed several of the CCTV cameras were Chinese models, and I just thought, this is nuts. I mean, they were probably put in a few years ago before people started waking up to this. But you're right. I mean, I doubt very much whether there are armies of people in underground bunkers in Beijing, you know, watching these corridors. But theoretically, they can. And they want to know which officials from which British establishment are in this training area, you know, because people still think of espionage as James Bond, as opposed to 976,000 small pieces of information that are somehow put together.
Well, I used to write databases for a living, and even when they were meant to be secure as a programmer, you'd always leave yourself a back way in, and it's really easy to do, and they were really, really difficult to spot.
Not even.
Well, I think this is behind. I was just poorly paid.
Do you want a job?
No, but this is... yes, please. This was the thing behind Biden. I think Biden's been pushing for American to take over like the semiconductor manufacturing, get it back in America, which makes total sense, because the way that's been allowed to sort of drift to the Far East was just a recipe for disaster.
Well, that's another story that they've just done. The Dutch, because the Netherlands is one of the world's leading super semiconductor manufacturers. I mean, they are probably... You know, there is nobody better than them. There may be people as good as them, but there's nobody better than the Dutch. And they've just agreed under not particularly heavy American pressure not to transfer any of their chips, the superconductor chips, to China, nor any of the technology. The Americans are a little bit behind them, and they're doing that. They're not allowing China any of their stuff either, because basically the more advanced Western countries and South Korea and Taiwan are probably a decade ahead of the Chinese. And these are the stuff that you need for artificial intelligence. And the only way to stay 10 years ahead of them is while you advance, you try to make sure that they don't accelerate their advances and catch up with you. So that's what that's about. Anyway, look, who is this geezer Ron DeSantis? From which state is he? And why might he be the next president of the United States of America?
Florida's current Republican governor. People think he's going to become the next president. I'm very dubious about it. I think he's liked by people who don't watch American politics very much, because he sounds, you know, popular. He sounds very, very Republican. He's very, very right wing. And I think it's just a little bit. We're in a bit of a phony war at the moment between Trump and DeSantis. An interesting poll came out, I think, about a week ago. I think it was one of the Florida universities, a poll which placed Trump, I think Trump had 50% of the vote and DeSantis had like 51 or 52%
of the Republican vote.
Of the Republican
yes.
vote.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, the point was, whatever the poll was, DeSantis was leading, which you could argue was the headline, but actually it was in Florida. Trump wasn't far behind. Trump's been quiet for a few months. The nation hasn't really seen DeSantis. He's got some quite extreme views, especially on gender issues. He's
well, it didn't do Trump much harm, did it? First time.
Trump was never as extreme, oddly enough, as
He started out as a liberalish Democrat, didn't he?
It is, and catch him on the right day, he can still sound like a liberalish Democrat. And I don't necessarily think DeSantis against Trump, DeSantis wins. I think Trump is badly scarred by many, many things, and he is getting older, and people are bored with him.
It's those sunbeds that do it.
And his biggest problem at the moment, and its biggest problem actually going into the election, might be the media. The media aren't going to give him anywhere near as much coverage. But he's got this sticking factor.
Hang on, they're not going to give Trump as much coverage?
They're already not giving a Trump as much coverage.
Media tend to like nice, shiny things that make good ratings.
You are talking about Trump, not DeSantis. They've moved to DeSantis. I mean, Murdoch's apparently back in DeSantis. Fox is kind of gone cool on Trump a little bit.
Well, yeah, there was that great story about that. That bloke always looks really puzzled on telly on Fox News. What's his name?
Oh, Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson. He always looks really confused. I mean, he's not. I'm not saying he's thick, but he always has this incredibly I'm confused about this look on his face when he's presenting.
Yeah. He's a little bit of one of these, like he's a bit of a TV conservative, but behind the scenes, it's an act.
Yeah, because I don't know if you saw this story. He has been found to have been really disparaging about Trump in private, despite being one of his greatest cheerleaders on Fox.
Yeah, it's funny because Brian Stelzer, he used to run do the media show on CNN. He wrote a book about Fox News about 2 years ago. It's a really insightful book, but one of the things he said is early in his career, one of the most helpful and charming people who'd helped him become like the CNN, get his job at CNN, was Tucker Carlson. He was like, he wasn't the figure who he's become. So I think that's the problem with Fox News. A lot of what you see is just the surface marketing playing to a base.
I can't stand professional polemicists, paying the mortgage by thinking, what extreme opinion can I now have? I mean, get a real job.
Yeah. That's totally, it's as true in this country as it is in America.
Yeah, I hate it.
I often think how much money I could make if I just sort of decided just to write from an extremely hardened position on either the left or the right, and as opposed to sort of having whatever my opinion is on the day.
It's really boring being middle of the road, even if most people are middle of the road.
It's difficult. It's really difficult being nuanced. I mean, we don't need to get into the Lineker story, but the Lineker story was like a case of where you've either got to be on really Gary on, you've got to be on Gary Lineker's side, or you've got to be on the side of like anti. Whereas, like, I don't actually like Gary Lineker because I personally think I don't think the BBC, a public broadcaster, should be paying anybody over $1 million a year just to read an article. I don't have no problem with the bloke. I just think the culture of extreme wealth paying the BBC is terrible.
Well, that story was one of those where you could see it happening in real time. So person A looks at the story and thinks, perhaps even subconsciously, that their politics are X, Y, and Z, and consequently, that's the position I'm going to take on this. And then person B...
It's really
B,
fascinating because... Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, so I was going to say, because very few people seem to read what he wrote. Everybody jumps, he's compared to the Nazis. Well, no, he did.
Good. We get to disagree. I think he did. Yes, I know what the tweet says, and the word Nazi is not in the tweet, but if you're going to talk about redolent or... reminiscent of 1930s Germany, that is exactly what you mean. And that, for me, was way, way, way off the mark. Alistair Campbell did something similar as well. He talked about the scrapping of the BBC singers, is it? The choir singers. Yeah. He said, this is also reminiscent of Germany in the 1930s and the attack on culture. No, it's not. It's a budget cut.
I take your point, but I the thing I wrote today, I was pointing out the fact that I think the language all around this story is just positioned in a place where it's just getting anger both sides. It gives both sides enough.
I think his Lineker's tweet was intemperate. I think he doesn't actually know how little he knows about many of the subjects he talks about. Could say that for a lot of us, of course.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Right, but I absolutely defend his right to say it. I would prefer that anybody on the BBC was sensible enough. Just keep it to yourself. You're at the BBC. And I don't care if it's sport or anything else. However, given that Alan Sugar says X, Y, and Z, given that Michael Portillo, oh, I think he's on GB News as well, he's also on the BBC and can tweet and say, I think Gary Lineker should be allowed to say what he did, even if I do think what he said was stupid. I'm absolutely in favour of it. Not the...
I think it was unfortunate the way he said it, but I understand why he said it, because I think the language that the government's been using around the migrant crisis is extremely...
Yeah, but it's Godwin's law, isn't it? Ugly. You know,
I do think we go to Hitler in two steps, but I do think there is a very worrying aspect of authority.
Yeah, I don't like the language, I just think it's hyperbole and a lack of historical
when you're saying
perspective
it's
and knowledge
you're saying
to go. By the way, it's seven steps, isn't it? Is that seven steps, Godwin's law? Yeah.
I don't know, but I do know. I do, and whether you say it's an attack of culture, I do think there is an attack of culture going on. Very, very.
Yeah.
Much.
Oh, no, there's without doubt a culture war going on, and I suspect the Conservatives will mostly lose it. We shall see. Oh, but sorry, going back to DeSantis. If he got the nomination, I cannot see Donald Trump saying, hey, you know what, Ron? Well played. Good guy.
No.
Fair fight. I'll go and take my ball home. No, he's going to say, screw you, I'm running as an indie.
Yeah, I think that, and I think that's going to give the Democrats more chance. But I think the elephant in the room here is
Trump.
Biden.
Oh, sorry.
Biden, because what's not really being spoken is somebody described him the other day as the most consequential president since FDR. He has got a hell of a lot done. You know,
please.
The media's going to keep showing him doddering around. Oh,
yeah, okay,
looking
just
after
let me have a think about that. FDR. Okay. Harry Truman.
No. I'm not necessarily saying
no, but I'm blaming you. No, but you've given me the, you know,
as
you give me an open
as
door.
But you compare his achievements compared to Trump's. I mean, there's no comparison.
Yeah, but hang on.
Trump's
but this person, whoever it was, is comparing, is saying the most consequential since FDR, which allows me to say, hang on, Harry Truman oversaw the launch of the two nuclear bombs on Japan. Hang on a minute. Eisenhower and the Korean War.
I think they're talking about domestically.
And more importantly, going on from Nixon, is Reagan.
Well,
you cannot persuade me that Biden's influence on the world and the USA is more than Nixon's.
No, you're talking about geopolitics. I don't think anybody would claim Biden has had an impact on geopolitics as much as those. I mean, okay, he supported Ukraine, which in itself might not have happened under Trump, but domestically he's been pretty he's got
more
quite
than,
a lot
more than
on,
Reagan?
On, with relatively... Look, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that's how he's perceived. And what I'm saying is, going into the next election, it depends on who the Democrats run. The Democrats are notoriously for shooting themselves in the foot. I'm beginning to think as calm and as measured a presidency as Biden has had, I begin to think that age is catching up to him now. So DeSantis against Biden, I don't know how American public's going to view him. I still think they would probably go for Biden because I think DeSantis is deeply divisive, and I think the lingering story here in American politics is, as we saw in the midterms, is the abortion. It's still going to be niggling away, and DeSantis is even more of an ardent culture warrior than even Trump was.
But you reckon Trump is still well in it and could make it again, yeah?
I got
to the nomination.
Feeling that I just think that the media are underestimating Trump and Trump's base. I don't think people have seen enough of DeSantis to be able to sort of say he's the new great hope for the Republican Party. Because another thing that you hear muttered often about DeSantis is people love him until they get to know him. And I think he's that kind of figure, is like, he's a great alternative to Trump.
People say that about
my
you,
God,
David.
Boring.
They don't say that about you, David. I'm really sorry. I wish I hadn't said that. By all means, edit it out. I love you.
Everything in. Anyway, what do you want to? What have we moved? Sorry, what have we done? Do you want to quickly touch on Israel, because we did actually have a request that
yes.
give your.
This is another story that is. I mean,
political crisis.
Yeah, it's quite consequential in many ways. It hasn't got that much coverage, and we are actually also talking about a relatively small country, but of course, it punches way above its weight, Israel, in so many ways, whether it's science or tech. Anyway, yeah, the point being,
I'd also say that this story also mirrors what's been happening in this country and to a certain extent in America, so it's kind of one of a kind, isn't it?
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, yeah. I mean, look, Israel, for all its legions of faults and the problem of the occupied territories, is a democracy. And in fact, it's quite a vibrant one, and it's also a very liberal, compared to its neighbours, a very, very liberal society with, this freedom of worship for all religions. Gay rights there are probably more advanced than in many parts of Europe, and certainly light years away from, again, all their neighbours, etc., etc. But the problem is that... it's a coalition government system. There's always problems with that. And the Knesset, the parliament, is a deeply divided place. They always have coalition governments. Netanyahu's come back in. He's far from as right-wing as many people think he is, but he is someone who is always determined that he will be in power. So he's put together this, what is probably the most right-wing government in Israel's history, and it has brought into the coalition some extremely extreme right religious people and other extreme right less religious people. So one of the things they're doing, and the thing that has caused all these massive demonstrations, probably the biggest ever seen in Israel, and it's not just in Tel Aviv, which is the great sort of liberal big city of the country, but in Jerusalem and in Haifa and other places. Basically, he's bringing in these judicial reforms, which will enable the Knesset, which has got 120 seats, that if you can get a majority of 61, which you can with your coalition government, you can override the Supreme Court. Because at the moment, you can enact a law, and this does happen, and the Supreme Court says, look, there are real problematic things about this law, given our constitution and given our society, and the laws can be struck down by the Supreme Court. That, if these things go through in a couple of weeks, will come to an end. So will the Supreme Court's ability to rule on reasonability. Netanyahu was recently appointed as a minister, a guy called Ira Dery. And this guy has got several criminal convictions, the last one just last year. Is he a fit and proper person to be a minister of state in a democracy with all these criminal convictions? The Supreme Court said no, that it was highly unreasonable and struck it down. Well, that is going to go. You can't have those grounds anymore. Two more. They're going to change the appointment of the judges. At the moment, there's a legal committee outside of government that has the majority decisions on who will be the judges in the Supreme Court. That's going to change, and the balance of power will go back to the politicians. Last one. The government ministers have legal advisors, and they come from the civil service, so that allegedly they're impartial. That is going to change. They will be able to choose their own legal advisors, who, of course, will obviously say, what a good idea. Nothing illegal about that. On you go, sir. So the Israelis who oppose this, and they are across the political spectrum from left to centre and even soft right, say this is actually going to change the nature of this democracy, that it's going to start it down the road towards the authoritarian governments that we see in places like Turkey or even Iran and Russia. So, sorry, right, to come to the end of it, that is what is the big issue, and they say this is about the future of democracy in Israel. The alternative argument to all this that Netanyahu and others make is that how can we govern when time and again the people have elected a government through a coalition, we've enacted these laws, and then the Supreme Court just strikes them down So it's a massive battle for the heart and soul of the democracy.
Yeah, but it's not exactly like we haven't heard before. I mean, it's the old argument about the power of the executive, isn't it? They had it in America under Trump. I think it was somebody like Newt Gingrich. Or,
well, yeah, and the politicians, of course, putting forward the judges, which is links back to your story about the abortion laws.
Yeah, but I mean, it's the idea that the power of the executive should have the power rather than, in the case of America, Congress, or in the case of this country, as we saw over the Brexit thing, it was they didn't like the. I mean, basically, Boris didn't really like the. I mean, and to go even further back to a certain extent, Blair, they didn't like Parliament. They just wanted to, they laid down the law. They expected the Parliament to rubber stamp it. You know, this is the same story through all democracies. It's the tension between, you know, having the power but also the restraints on power.
Well, that's why there always has to be a keen watch on them. Now, I've been following you on Twitter, my friend.
Oh God.
No. Well, apart from the train journeys and the cups of coffee and the cafes, it's a good thing.
I'm getting out more.
It's good. I've always said you should get out more, David. It's a good thing because you've become re-obsessed by films, which is one of my obsessions, and a year. We have spoken, if anyone's listening to this, to each other, you know, outwit.
I'm going to embarrass you now, I'm going to keep this in. I'm not going to edit it out, but I'm going to thank you because, as you people probably know, my mum died in December, and you were one of the few people to actually reach out to me, so... That meant a lot to me. So
well, thank you, David. It wasn't a pleasure, but I was happy to do it.
I know.
I was happy to do it.
I'd like to kind of acknowledge when people do good things. So thank you.
God bless you. Let's get back to films. You made an old man very happy. seen any good films? It allows me to say because you've now had a lot more time able to watch any films.
Have you seen any good films recently, David? Yes, I've been watching so many good films. Actually, I saw a really bad film. I saw Cocaine Bear the other week. Do you know what? I'd gone to see the comedian Simon Munnery. I'd gone to see him in Liverpool, and I didn't know he was signing stuff at the end, and I didn't have any money on me. And I thought, sod it, I'll go back the next night. So I went to see him in Manchester. Got stranded in Manchester, so I had to get like a hotel room for the night.
Yeah, I got stranded in Manchester recently. They kept us in for half an hour, right? At Old Trafford, because we're Leeds fans, right? Well, okay, fine. It does lessen the trouble, and there was some at Ellen Road when they came. I understand. But when the Scousers beat Man U 7-0 to the week, I noticed with about 15 minutes to go, most of the Man United fans were leaving. How come they're not kept in at Anfield if we're kept in at Old Trafford? Answer me that.
Yeah. I'd imagine it's down to the local police. I think
Liverpool police. Oh, hang on a minute. And I was at Liverpool as well. We beat them 2-1. We got held in Anfield this season when we beat them 2-1 for half an hour. So if the Leeds fans are held in for half an hour at Anfield, why aren't the Man United fans held in?
Maybe you have a reputation. Serious question is, if you leave early, do you still get stopped from leaving early?
You can't leave early.
Oh, okay.
And the bloody plod... they're not called plod. The Busies, as I believe they're known in those parts, they didn't hold us at the gates. They held us on the terraces. So you had all these kids, 12-year-olds, 10, you know, been chugging Coca-Cola all afternoon. Women, men of a certain age, couldn't go to the loo. You're held on the terraces. We couldn't even go down to the concourse.
You need to either speak to the mayor of Liverpool or the mayor of... I'll have a word with Andy Burke.
Well, having been beaten around the legs by one of those coppers with a nightstick when I was a youth, I don't hold much... all I'd done was go under the stand and have a cup of coffee, I don't hold much...
Did you see any good films recently?
Sorry about that. I just went off.
I was going to tell you my Andy Burnham story.
Yeah, do.
Oh, no, I just were taking pictures in Manchester a few weeks ago, and I took a picture of a bloke through a gate, like just walking past. And when I got home, I realised it was Andy Burnham. So I stick it on Twitter, and I said, do you think this is Andy Burnham? And Andy Burnham said, yeah, that's me.
He's got lovely eyes, isn't he? Lovely eyes.
I've seen loads of great films. I've been watching loads of spaghetti. I love westerns, so I've been going back to watching all the spaghetti westerns.
Such as?
Going through a bit of a...
Once Upon a Time in the West.
I love Once Upon a Time in the West. I forgot what a great film it was.
Two Meals for Sister Sarah.
Yeah, Sergio Leone. I've not got up to the Eastwoods yet, but the Eastwoods aren't really spaghettis. I've been watching a lot. I watched Django. I watched a cracky one called Kiyomi. It was with Nero. Nero. Oh, God, as soon as I need to come up with his name,
well, the guy Emperor Chango. Nero.
No, Nero.
Robert De Niro.
Nero. I did. I'm gonna look him up now. He played Django.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Nero.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Nero.
Him. Him that no one else has ever seen because we're old and yeah, carry on.
It's got the weirdest soundtrack, really weirdest theme song.
You don't stop. I don't want now to take your life away. No, I won't be seen.
What does mean I can't stop to follow those who destroy the land of the one I love?
And it was actually sung by Ian Duncan Smith's wife, Franco Nero, actor, Italian actor. It's actually sung by Ian Duncan Smith's sister. It's an amazing little fact I discovered.
Yeah,
this weird American spaghetti western from the early 70s. Yeah, it's got the weirdest song. Anyway. Love that one. So yeah, I'm watching all the old spaghetti westerns.
Okay, and Cocaine Bear. I've only seen the trailers, and I just thought, what a great idea. I mean, obviously, you know, allegedly based on a true story, but they've, you know, apparently in real life, the bear sniffed some cocaine, lasted about 35 minutes before it was shot. But it, in the movie, you know, it's somewhat longer.
Yeah, and I just don't know if cocaine has that effect on them. It was a crazy, silly film, but I watched it in an almost empty cinema about midnight.
It does have that effect. We were at Fulham. Fulham away in the cup a couple of weeks ago, a night match, and I don't know if you know, but there's so much coke in young fans in football now.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
That's why when you go to the ground, there's always now at least one.
I go to poetry nights. I don't understand.
Well, they're the worst,
this,
mate. I tell you, there's a coked up bloke in Tesco today. I think it was like 12 o'clock in the afternoon. Anyway, no, we were at Fulham. This is why there's always dogs, police dogs, and they're sniffing around trying to catch these kids, and there were three coked up lads in their early 20s, about two rows in front of us, and they were so coked up they had a go at these two young women in their sort of late teens that were stood in front of us. And there's just so much of it about. Sorry. So Cocaine Bear, you don't rate. Have you seen Everything Never Mind? What is it all about?
Oh,
Never All the Time.
Yeah, I did. I watched that a few weeks ago. It was okay, but it wasn't. I tell you, the film that should have won was the Banshees of Inisherin. Mm. That was an unbelievably good film. I didn't like Everything All. I mean, it was okay, but it was a lot of kind of distraction from what was essentially a very simple message, which was like, look after your mum, which is like,
Yes, well, it was about the Chinese immigrant experience in America, the second generation experience. It was about the mother-daughter relationship. And it was told in a relatively, I mean, I know, I
complicated.
Yeah, people have said
exciting.
It was revolutionary filmmaking. Nah, there's some of those ideas have been done before, but I liked it. It was at least 30 minutes too long, but yeah, it was a good film.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, liked it. Good film. Would watch it again. Might even buy it if it was on DVD. All those things. Was it the best film deserving? Like, was it 7 Oscars? No. And for the best supporting actor, I would want the guy out of the two supporting actors out of Banshees of Inisherin.
I think that bear in Cocaine Bear should have got it.
I'm disappointed Cocaine Bear didn't get anything.
None of them are a patch on the last film I've seen, which is The Lady from Shanghai.
Oh, the Orson Welles with the mirror scenes.
Orson Welles, what is it, 40s, 1940s? It's a bit of a film noir, and he's got the worst or the best Irish accent you've ever heard. Bless him. But it's the reason that I just got obsessed with the end, and I was thinking about it all day, the end
sequence.
The mirror
scene.
Do what?
It's really... The mirror scene.
With the mirrors, yeah. Because there's a new film, and I've forgotten what it is. You know, every decade, there's a big film comes out that pays homage to the lady from Shanghai and the mirror scene. I mean, they did it in Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon, didn't they? Things like that.
Enter the Dragon,
So I just got fixated with it, so I just had to... it was on, I think
that
it was
is,
on Netflix.
That is really weird because I've become fixated on it because I've seen it in about three films. It was in Zardoz. Have you seen the Sean Connery film? Really weird. Where he wears a loincloth.
No.
Zardoz.
No. Isn't that The Man Who Would Be King?
No, Zardoz. It's a futuristic,
But he does wear a sort of bit of a loincloth in the manner. Anyway,
it does work. He's a proper Mankini.
Was he in Outland?
Oh God, I watched Outland the other night. Oh, I loved Outland.
Is Connery in Outland?
Yes, he is.
Which is for people that don't like films and have already got on to far more interesting podcasts about international relations.
We always have a film section. But I've become obsessed with it because I was watching a Klaus Kinski film, a spaghetti western, which also ended with a mirror scene, and it's like turned up in about four or five films I've watched recently. It's like every third film I'm watching lately has got a bloody mirror scene where they end up shooting the mirrors. Great scene though. A great film, Lady in Shanghai, from Shanghai. Not seen it in a while. I'll add it to my list.
Good man. Well, I think
do you want to call that a...
Sorry, go on.
You take over.
Goodbye. Sorry, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, we finished. All right. So, okay. Well, I hope we'll do another one of these, like...
I do. But look, David, if there's anything on your mind, anything you want to get off your chest,
Why have we taken so long? You know, where have you been? Have you been writing a book? What's it called again?
I'm glad you asked that. Thank you, David. It's called The Future of Geography, and it's about space. And it's about satellites, and it's about rare earth materials, and it's about how international relations is now played out there. So if you're interested in international relations, this book's for you. But I couldn't resist it.
Can I not plug my book?
Yes.
My new book. Oh, well, I finished a new book. It's called Patriot Idiots. It's 101 profiles of some of the craziest cranks in the UK. And it's not being published anywhere because I'm still looking for an agent. And I keep getting awful messages from agents saying, we're not interested. So,
you're lucky to get a reply, mate.
Oh, I know. It's hell. Anyway, I did finish a book.
Given that numerous literary agents listen to this podcast...
If you want to get in touch,
just go through it again. What's it called and what's it about?
It's 101 completely fake profiles. Because you know, there's so
and how many profiles do you do?
101 of them, and they're fully illustrated. And I've written 101 completely fake profiles, biographies of 101 figures in the British media.
Name
establishment
one.
And politics. Anne Widdecombe, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the full lot. You know,
like it
all the way through to the Farages and the
and what you anyway, you profile them in your own inevitable
I've
manner.
I've done a crazy, I've done a crazy, caricature of them on one page, and then there's a full solid.
Ooh, hang on a minute. When you say caricature, do you mean a drawing?
I've done a drawing.
I'll buy that.
Caricatured. I know you would. It's a really good book. People who've seen it love it. It's just I can't get an agent interested. So anyway,
okay, agents, you heard it here first.
The profile's made up of completely fake facts, so there's not a single book. There's an entire book of lies, but hopefully funny lies. So that's the premise. I think it's a really nice idea.
Well, like Anne Widdecombe started her career in Raymond's Review Bar, things like that, yeah?
Well, exactly. If you could imagine that for like 101 people, completely fake.
Jacob Rees-Mogg's grandfather was a miner from Durham.
Yeah. Exactly, but like he's got the largest head in the country, and it's going to be housed in the bloody National Gallery after he's dead or something. You know, I can't.
Boris Johnson
that.
Is overweight because he eats so much Turkish delight.
That is exactly what the book is. It is a book of 101 lies and extremely kind of strange profiles.
Love it.
Caricatures. Love it. So anyway, so I have not been lazy. Whilst the podcast been off there, I finish my book. You finish your book. Yours is available to be by soon. And mine, eventually, hopefully. Anyway, so let's do another podcast, maybe this year.
You can't rule it out. See you, mate.
You'll be doing loads of other people's podcasts. Can't you just do this one? Promise me. When you start your, publicity tour, come on this podcast.
Might do.
Right. Okay.
See ya.
See you then.
Bye, mate.
That was the What and the Why podcast with Tim Marshall and David Waywell. No animals were harmed during the recording of this podcast, except for three wolves, a snout-headed lungfish, and a kestrel called Keith. Mr. Marshall's new book, The Future of Geography, How Power and Politics in Space Will Change Our World, is out on 27th April 2023. Dr. Waywell is currently available to hire for private lap dances, public gyrations, but no kinky stuff. Well, maybe just a bit of kinky stuff for the right money. The point is, he's open to negotiations.